Welcome to Harry W. Schwartz Books Audio Bookcast, the leader in online book readings. Harry W. Schwartz is an independent bookstore founded in 1927 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We have received numerous awards for our dedication to community involvement and were named Publishers Weekly Bookseller of the Year in 2004. We host over 350 author events each year. Visit us at www.schwartzbooks.com for our bookcast directory, to download the newest fiction and nonfiction bookcasts, and to browse our wide selection of autographed books at cover prices. While you're there, check out Schwartz Gives Back, our community nonprofit charity and customer rewards program, our upcoming events, or leave a customer review. Again, that's www.schwartzbooks.com. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Harry W. Schwartz on Downer. We are honored and excited to host these enriching author events, and everyone at Schwartz Bookshops thanks you for supporting this program through attending and making us your preferred bookseller. I'd like to take a moment to tell you about some of our upcoming events. On Thursday, March 2nd, Liam Callanan, an English professor at UWM and also a frequent contributor to WUWM's At 10, will read from his acclaimed first novel, The Cloud Atlas. On Wednesday, March 8th, we will host Danielle Trussoni. Ms. Trussoni is a Wisconsin native, and she will read from her memoir, Falling Through the Earth. On March 9th, Daniel Sherman and Terry Narden will discuss their new book, Terror, Culture, Politics. And tonight, we are particularly honored to be joined by Sister Helen Prejean. We at Schwartz Bookshops believe that bookselling is a cultural and political expression, an expression of progressive change, and of challenge to oppressive authority, a search for a community of values which can act as an underpinning of a better world. Tonight, it is with this belief in mind that we are proud to host Sister Helen Prejean. She is here to talk about her new book, The Death of Innocence. She shares with us in this book the heart-wrenching and fatal injustice that exists throughout the United States. So tonight, let us open up our hearts, listen, and work to begin a new conversation that will end the death penalty in America. Please welcome Sister Prejean.
Thank you. Thank you. They never introduced me in a bookstore in New Orleans like that. So I just got to say, you know, I've been at this 20 years getting on airplanes and traveling around the United States, and I'm sure I've traveled as much as anybody who sought national office, and more, really, because it's what I do, to keep the conversation alive. And, you know, there's a little mystery game going on in this bookstore tonight, and the mystery game is how many people here are nuns? All right, so we're going to have a little truth count here. Truth count, no fudging. You can't be a nun for a night, okay? So who are the real nuns? Raise your hand. Ah, look at that. Sprinkled in. Good. I never knew I was going to write a book. I was an English major, and those of us who have had the benefit of education, our education sits inside us like seeds. And, you know, I've been in Australia several times, and there's something called fire forming. There are some seeds that only sprout in fire. And the Aboriginal people, that the oldest continuous living civilization on Earth, knew how to farm in the red hot desert of Australia, and so they'd set fire to a patch of trees and grass and bushes, and then in a couple of months they would come back and it would be green because the seeds had sprouted through fire. And I guess I'm like that the seed of myself as an author, as a speaker, sprouted in fire, literally, really. Because the first man I accompanied to execution in 1984 was Patrick Saunier, and he was electrocuted. and I was there. And it's all about a journey. Dead Man Walking is part one of the journey, and I'm going to give you some of the main spots in that journey, and then in Death of Innocence, because I continue to accompany people on death row in the United States. Right now I'm with the seventh and eighth person, Manuel Ortiz in Louisiana, a man from El Salvador, who's innocent. He's the third one, and the last two people I've been with that are in this book, Dobie Gillis Williams, African-American man with an IQ of 65, who was executed in Louisiana, and Joseph Odell, a man in Virginia, who for 11 years asked the courts to let him have one full evidentiary hearing, and he was executed in Virginia. And I believe those two people were innocent. When you read this book, you will have more knowledge of what happened than the poor citizen jurors selected, told to play God, given distorted evidence, given jailhouse snitches, lies, and they don't know the difference. They're just doing the best they can. And let me just say this of the wisdom and goodness of the people of Wisconsin that have had the wisdom all these years. You've never had the death penalty, have you? I don't think your state ever had. When? When did you have it? There you go, 1867. And then after that, you did away with it. Well, that's a good hunk of time. The rest of the country now is trying to join you. You're going to have your little politicians going to pop up. They're going to run for governor or something. They're going to say, Wisconsin needs the death penalty. It's going to be the politicians who are going to bring it up because they hope to get political currency from it. But we're watching right now, started in 2001, we have 122 wrongfully convicted people who have come off a death row in the United States, and they're all telling their horror stories on the nightly TV program. Oh, yeah, I had a trial. It's like the assumption in this country is if you've had your day in court and they find you guilty and you're sentenced to death, well, we got the best court system in the world. We got all those appeals courts, and they're going to catch the mistake. Well, I'll get into that. Why the appeals courts are not about reopening evidence and catching mistakes because of the way that they're run. But I'm jumping ahead of myself just a little bit. But I just want to say, Wisconsin, you can't rest in it and say, oh, we'll never have it. Because never underestimate politicians and what they'll try to do. Look at what happened in New York, George Pataki, 10 years ago. He almost made me wreck the community car. He was campaigning, and I heard him on NPR. I heard him saying, oh, yeah, we need the death penalty in New York. It's going to deter crime. Anybody who knows this issue, I mean, it's so clear now. We have a track record for 30 years of doing the death penalty since 76, and it's so obvious that the states that practice executions the most have double the homicide rate of states that never practice. It's got nothing to do with deterrence. And he brought it into New York, and they only 2 years ago, they finally put it down after the Supreme Court overturned the statute, and then the Republican-led one of the houses, it just did a quick fix on the statute, but then it hit the other house, and they said, wait a minute, and they had hearings in New York, and 9 out of every 10 New Yorkers that testified said, why do we need this? We've had it for 9 years, and it's cost us over $180 million. And we haven't executed anybody. There are 4 people on death row. It's like a political trophy. The people could see that. And it's not like money's neutral. Martin Luther King used to say the most moral document in the world you'll ever look at is a budget. And to spend $180 million to have this death machinery political symbolism in place, think of what you could do with $180 million with that risk, kids. And when are we going to start having places where people can deal with addictions? And, you know, 2/3 of the Bush administration budget is to criminalize drugs and throw people in prison. That's all they can think of is criminalize, throw people away in prison, or use violence to try to hold the social order in place. And that's what I've come to learn. The death penalty is a paradigm for a lot of things. What do you do about crime? Well, you don't get to the roots of it. You don't look at poverty. You don't look at people without jobs. You don't look at terrible public education. What you do is say, we'll select the worst of the worst of these terrible criminals, and we'll execute them, and that's going to, it's using violence to try to control the social order. That writ large is the war on terrorism. Remember the deck of cards going around with Osama bin Laden and his family? And like, select the enemy, dehumanize the enemy, terminate the enemy. And that's going to make us all safer. As if it's going to make us safer. Let me tell you my journey. It started out, the reason that I have gone to death row and I even got involved in it was, I came to understand about the gospel of Jesus. I mean, I love the people that are now digging into this religion stuff and how right-wing religion has taken Jesus hostage. I mean, because we got Jesus quoted for war in Iraq and born-again Christians, and I call all of that Christianity light, L-I-T-E, light. And it's used for violence. It's used for tax cuts to the rich. The name of God is trotted out for everything. I came to understand that Jesus was someone who was on the side of the poor, the disenfranchised, those that were considered disposable human waste in his society. When I came to understand that, then I came to understand that working for justice, before I was charitable, charity's a lot easier than justice. Because charity, you know, be kind, everybody like, don't gossip, all that. You know, that's fine. Charity's fine. But justice means you got to look at the system. You got to use your brain. You got to analyze what's going on here. You know, since George Bush has been president of the United States, poverty has risen 17%. 17%. Is that an accident? Is it an accident that some people are getting richer and some people are getting poor? And, like, who cares? I mean, you know, well, as long as it doesn't hit me in my pocketbook. But we have to care because we need to be big-souled and we need to have public virtue, not just a little private virtues, but public virtue. We have to care about our community, about our society. So when I came to understand about Jesus and justice, then I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Projects in New Orleans. That's who you saw left in the Superdome after Katrina. How do you have an evacuation plan for a city that doesn't include 150,000 people who don't have cars? And you know how you do that? You do that in the same way that across the inner cities of America right now, we got people drowning. Hurricanes are only one way to drown. There's a lot of ways to drown. Poverty drowns you. Lack of health care drowns you. Living in neighborhoods where you can't afford rent in another part of the neighborhood and kids getting involved with drugs and violence drowns you. Prisons drown you. One in every three young African-American men ages 18 to 29 are in the prison system in the United States. One in every three. 2.1 million people incarcerated in the United States. Every year, the equivalent of the population of Seattle is released from prison. And now that you got private industry coming into the prison thing, it's one of the growing industrial growth that's going on, not just in the United States, but in the world. And you have prisons sprouting up everywhere. I'm talking colleges and universities, criminal justice. Everybody's got a criminal justice because they're all going to work in the prisons. In California, 8 years ago, the budget switched. They had always put more into education than prisons. And 8 years ago, then the spiral started going down more into prisons and less into education. And this is a death path. This is a downward spiral for all of us. Because, see, it's based on this thing. Well, if we can separate out that criminal element, separate them out, throw them over the wall over there. I mean, you got gated communities on two ends in this country. You got the prison on one end, and then you got the people over there with their little gated community, too. Because we're scared of each other. And we're scared of each other because we don't mix. I mean, you see what we're doing tonight? You know what this is? This is like a local community university on wheels. Here we are coming together for discourse, for learning, for sharing. And the more we come together And the more we share, then we're not as afraid of each other. But we're very afraid of our poor. We're very afraid of certain neighborhoods. And then when we get our news about each other from TV, we're really in trouble. Because no matter how many peaceful, wonderful things happen among the citizens of Milwaukee today, guess what you're going to see on the evening news? How many muggings or rapes or whatever violence, like a heat-seeking radar, they're going to pull that out and give it to you before you go to bed tonight. And people then have this exaggerated sense of how dangerous it is out there, so we got to do something. We got to fight fire with fire. We got to be tough on crime. So do the ultimate penalty. Bring in the death penalty. That, boy, people think twice when they're getting ready to kill that witness. Oh, I might get the death penalty. Yeah, right. The police chiefs of this country were polled and asked about they were given 10 remedies to stop violence in the community. Every one of them put the death penalty dead last. Because they said people who do crimes and violence are not thinking of consequences. So like you could burn people in oil, boil them in oil in the public square if you're not thinking of consequences. And just think of it for a minute. Do I kill a person or like where I'll get death penalty or then there's life without parole? Let me think about this. I mean, really. People are not, because you're getting an eddy of a river, you're getting a current, and often it's laced with alcohol or drugs, and when you got a gun, boom. The warden of the Louisiana State Penitentiary told me one time, I asked him, I said, warden, I just know a couple of the guys on death row. I only take one person at a time to accompany them. And I said, but you know all the guys on death row. Do you ever talk to anybody in Louisiana? You know, we're one of the big executing states. Ever talk to anybody who said, maybe I better not do this. I might get the death penalty. And he laughed. He said, sister, the 5,000 guys we got in this prison never thought they were going to get caught. Much less the guys on death row. The people doing the thinking and the people doing the murdering are two separate sets of people. Now, we got a lot of the thinking people in here tonight. You read books, you engage, and you know, and so you think of actions. But, boy, when you're just living by the seat of your pants, laced with drugs and alcohol, and you got a gun, that's what we have to deal with. In fact, some of those police chiefs said, we need to get rid of the death penalty because the politicians in the legislatures and the Congress, they got a huge diversionary act, and they don't have to deal with the roots of violence as long as we got the death. Hey, we're solving the problem. Got the death penalty. When I got involved with poor people, I got an invitation one day to write a man on death row. It was 1982. We hadn't executed anybody in Louisiana in almost 20 years. Neither had you. The whole country, there was an unofficial moratorium on the death penalty that began in the 60s and into the 70s. Everybody really was surprised when the Supreme Court put the death penalty back in 1976. And so when I wrote the man, his name was Patrick Saunier, I thought that's all I was going to be doing was, you know, writing letters. I never dreamed they were going to kill this guy, much less that I'd be there. And that's the journey of Dead Man Walking. And I instinctively wrote it in first person, present tense. Didn't know a lot about the death penalty. I was learning about it like all other social justice issues. So I just take you with me. As I learn, you learn. Visiting him, finding out he had a brother who got two life sentences and he got death. That was my first legal question. How could there be a murder and one gets death and one gets life? And now I know that when you have two co-defendants in a murder and there are no other witnesses, if one gives state's evidence against the other, gets a reduced sentence for doing that, how do we know we're getting the truth? And more you're going to see the problem that we don't have a way of coming to absolute truth. We don't have a way of coming to minimum truth. I mean, you have to have truth-telling, which the courts are supposed to be. But I'll get into that in the second book. So I get involved with Pat Saunier. I get involved with his brother. I'm beginning to learn from the lawyers how the things work. Then the victim's family, I tell you about that too. Two teenage kids have been killed by these two brothers. And my own journey of the heart in this, which is never over. Because when I looked at the pictures in the newspaper and saw these two precious young kids, a boy 17, a girl 18, saw their pictures smiling in their prom outfit in this little daily newspaper in Cadiana, where Cajun people live, and then saw the scowling faces down at the bottom of the two men now that I'm visiting, and then read how these two kids were found lying face down near a sugarcane field and had been shot in the back of the head, and the girl had been raped. And I'm looking into the faces of the two men I'm visiting. And one of the things I've learned about the death penalty and why it's a tough one for all of us is that when we hear of the death of an innocent person, we feel outrage. And I just want to say as clearly as I can tonight, if we feel outrage at the death of an innocent person, that is a morally legitimate way to feel. We should feel outrage. Here's a mother with her two children carjacked and killed. Here's an elderly couple killed. And we're outraged over that because human life should not be violated. No human being should be ripped out of the fabric of life by acts of violence. That should happen to no one. And so we feel the outrage. And then it's like, what do we do with the outrage? And so it's real easy. Like I remember in Massachusetts, there had been two terrible killings. One was a policeman, one was a little child. And boy, the politicians were taking it to the bank, and they were going to try to bring the death penalty back to Massachusetts. And it's always around, look at this terrible murder. And there's something else I've learned in it, too. There is something in our culture that says the way the politicians try to legitimize it is equal justice. They killed their victim. They didn't respect their human rights. Equal justice means it's not right that they should be alive and their victim's dead, so we have to kill them. We have to. And that's a way to honor the victim. And boy, if you've ever been to a death penalty trial, of course you wouldn't because you don't have them here. But I've been at Capitol trials in Louisiana, and you see the prosecutor talking to the jury and saying, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, look at this poor family. They will never see their grandchildren. They have been deprived forever of their daughter. Justice for her, for their dead child, demands that you give us a sentence of death, because that's equal justice. And so what the cultural thing underneath it is, it's a way to honor the victim. And in fact, justice really demands it. In fact, if you don't give the death penalty, you're dishonoring the victim. And it's tough to make our way through that, because emotionally, being in the presence of people who have lost a child, we know we haven't suffered that same pain. And so when they are there in their loss and in their grief, and then you have the politician saying and the prosecutor saying, so ladies and gentlemen, the jury wants you to just stiffen that backbone and do what you need to do for the community, because we need to have tough love in this community. They call it by all kind of names. But when you distill it out, what it means is we want you to decide that we're going to kill the human being who did this. Now, what they never get into is, do you know that in Texas, when they execute people, first of all, let me just say, this is a fact in this book, over 80% of actual executions happened in the 10 southern states that practiced slavery. Does that surprise you that race is integral in this, controlling the black population because whites are scared? I mean, you're going to read the history of it. You're going to see it goes all the way back. As soon as the slave population were freed, whites were threatened, and it was to control. They had these black code books in the southern legislatures, and if a black man did a crime, what the punishment was. If a white person did a crime, what the punishment was. And a black man could steal an apple and be hung, and white people have to go kill a whole room full of people or something. It's never been equal, and it isn't today. The practice, look at the practice of it. And so we get into the death penalty, and part of it is honoring the victim. Part of it is fear. And But what happened to me, and I'll just give you a little synopsis of it right here, but I did make a terrible mistake because I was visiting Pat and his brother, and I hadn't reached out to the victim's family because I didn't know how to reach out to the victim's family. I went, they're not going to want to see me. I'm the spiritual advisor to the two people who killed their kids. And my heart went out to them, but I didn't know what to do. I had a great editor at Random House, Jason Epstein. When I wrote Dead Man Walking, when I wrote the first draft of the book, I really downplayed this terrible mistake of not reaching out to the victim's family. I just said I was confused. I'd never done this before. And he looks at it and he goes, Helen, he says, that was cowardice, wasn't it? And I go, yeah. He said, you were scared. Weren't you scared? I said, yeah. He said, look, when you write your book, take people with you on the peaks of the waves when you do things right, but take them in the troughs when you do it wrong. And this was a terrible mistake. And I met them at the worst possible time. It couldn't be more polarized because the last thing that happens before an execution in Louisiana is you have a pardon board hearing. It's a public hearing. It's the closest you can come to, like, being in the Roman amphitheater. You sign the book when you go in. Which side you on? Are you on the side of the state that wants to execute? Are you going to ask for clemency? Let the person live. And here the victim's family who've been on this terrible roller coaster of confusion and being told we're going to honor your dead child, we're going to get the death penalty for you. And here they're there at the pardon board hearing, usually asking for the death penalty. And then I tell you, I have seen mothers on both sides. I have seen the mother of someone who had their child killed saying to them, please, please give justice to my dead child. And then here's the mother of the one to be executed saying, please don't kill my boy. What human being can handle this? Who has the wisdom to know you live, you die? How do we, it's intractable to us. It's impossible for us to be able to sort this through. Well, anyway, that's when I met the victim's family and their stories told in Dead Man Walking too. And then these tremendous human beings that I've met, these incredible heroes of grace, like Lloyd DeBlanc, whose son was killed, was the first victim's family to take me by the hand and bring me down the road. How does a family cope with this? Lose your son and not be swallowed up in the grief or not to want to return hate for hate and killing for killing. How do they do it? Well, you know what? We have a cloud of witnesses in this country of people who are doing it. This book is dedicated to murder victims, families for human rights. They have all lost loved ones. They have all seen through the death penalty, like Bud Welch, whose daughter Julie was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing. I end the book with him. And he says, by the time it came to the execution of Timothy McVeigh, 6 years after, 168 people's lives had been lost. He said most of the families had figured out that watching Timothy McVeigh die on closed circuit TV was not going to do anything for them. And that they, when they went home, the chair was still going to be empty. And that's what they really had to deal with, that if he lived or if he died, if he disappeared behind prison walls with 168 life sentences and they never heard from him again, they had to deal with the loss of their loved one. And all this is in Dead Man Walking, of dealing with the victims' families. And Lloyd DeBlanc, he's the hero. Dead Man Walking ends with, forgiveness was never going to be easy. Each day it must be prayed for and struggled for and won. And I take you unto both sides there with me and what I learned along the way and what I began to learn about the justice system, what I began to learn about what happens when poor people go to death row. And it's only poor people. I mean, the saying in the neighborhood at St. Thomas was capital punishment mean them without the capital get the punishment. I mean, everybody knew that. Because if you have resources and prosecutors are going to look at taking on somebody that's got excellent defense, they know they may face 100 pretrial motions even just to get started. And there'll be endless appeals. They're much more prone to just sit down, bargain it away. And you got to know that bargain basement justice controls 90% of all the criminal cases in the United States. It's sitting down. Look, if he pleads guilty, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. Never comes to trial. The courts couldn't stand that amount of trials. They couldn't stand it. So we got bargain basement justice going on. And if you're poor and you don't even have an attorney there, or they're in another room and they work out the rest of your life and they come back in and say, look, here's the best deal I could get for you. You got to plead guilty and you'll get manslaughter. You'll get 25, 30 years or you'll get life. Otherwise, if we roll the dice, as they say, and we go to trial, you might get the death penalty. And when the person says, but I'm innocent, doesn't matter. So we have innocent and guilty alike going into our prisons. Death of Innocence, I never dreamed I was going to write. I never dreamed that I was going to accompany then two people to execution that I became convinced were innocent. And it's going to have a deeply cathartic and purifying effect on you when you go through it. Because, you know, reading is a very intimate thing to do. You're in a private place. You use your own imagination. And I take you there through these two stories. Dobie's story is going to just break your heart. An African-American man, a white woman, was killed in her bathroom in Manny, Louisiana, the small town in Louisiana. White woman killed in her bathroom. The husband was the only witness. They never checked him out. They never checked his clothes. They never checked him out. And standard procedure when a spouse is killed is to check out the spouse. They never did that. And he told the police his wife's dying words. He heard her in the bathroom where she was being stabbed. A black man is killing me. A black man is killing me. They do a dragnet in the town, pull up three young black men. Dobie now, he has an IQ of 65. I visited with him for over 7 years. And he is taken from his grandfather's house, brought down in the police station from 2 to 5 in the morning. And they say, we got a confession. The audio tape broke. The videotape malfunctioned. But we have these three police officers, and he had an all-white jury. And then we start getting into the courts. How can a black man on trial for his life have an all-white jury, and you have it right there in the Constitution, a fair and impartial jury of your peers? How do the courts let that go? And then you got to get into what has happened to the Supreme Court over the last 20 years in the United States, the Rehnquist Court. The framers of the Constitution did allow for the death penalty. There are two instances where they do, where they state it, but they also allowed for constitutional protections of the lone individual brought up against the ultimate powers of the state. And one of those was to have a fair and impartial jury. And here's Dobie, all-white jury, white woman killed, policeman saying he confessed. And then when you read the scenario of the crime and how he supposedly killed Sonia Nippers in her bathroom, they took photos of the crime scene. The window that he supposedly came through looks huge. When you actually see it, it was as big as a microwave oven window. And they claimed that he crawled in through that bathroom window and waited behind the bathroom door. There happened to be a steak knife on the back of the toilet. Isn't that where you keep your steak knives? And because he didn't have any of the blood of the victim, he must have crawled in naked, crawled out naked. It's like Job, a bad far side version of Job, naked I came in this world, naked I left this world. And he waited behind the bathroom door till she came in. What if the husband went to the bathroom ahead of her? What? I mean, it didn't make any sense. And I'm learning about forensic evidence. I'm learning scenarios got to match the forensic evidence. I also learned that some of these great defense lawyers, every lawyer I meet is a hero for me, because I meet these lawyers who do this pro bono work to try to save lives. And Denny LaBeouf said, you know, sometimes when a person goes to trial and they're innocent, it's actually they are more vulnerable. Because they think, all I have to do is tell the truth, and they are never going to convict me. I just have to tell the truth. And what they don't realize is that you have competing scenarios of the crime, which the prosecution spins and which the defense is then supposed to counter. And if you don't have defense, you don't have forensic independent testing. You don't have eyewitnesses. You don't have any defense. And if you want to look at the main structural reason why we have so many innocent people going in along with the guilty, it is that when you go to trial, you're supposed to have an adversarial way of coming to truth. And if you don't have adversarial, if you have prosecution and you don't have defense, you don't have truth. And these poor jurors asked to play God, asked to come. Now, you listen to eyewitnesses, and you listen to those that are going to talk about the forensic testing, and you make a decision now, and then the crime's terrible in the community, and people are scared, and you got the prosecutor telling them now, stiffen your backbone, and do justice for the community. I tell the story in Death of Innocence about jurors. What happens to jurors when they don't get the truth? Or out of pressure, because you got to have 12 votes in most states. It's got to be unanimous. The lone juror who goes, I don't know. I don't know if we should kill him. You know, like I talk about one in New Orleans. I met the guy. You couldn't help but love the guy. He's a little bitty guy, a little Italian guy, a little nervous Italian guy. And he was on the jury for Robert Sawyer, who was executed in Louisiana. And Robert Sawyer had brain damage. Robert Sawyer, and he had an eye that went out. They barely have assembled the jury, and they have to stop because a little Italian guy is nervous. He said, he keeps looking at me. I know he's looking at me. He said, he's not looking at you. It's just he's got to be, okay, all right. Then they all get back. Okay, we get going. And the poor guy, what happens to him, because Robert Sawyer had no defense, and this guy kept looking at him, he said, I could tell a guy wasn't right. I mean, a guy wasn't right. But the defense didn't present anything about brain damage, anything. And then we all in there to vote. Okay, we found him guilty. It was a terrible crime. A person had been murdered, body burned, terrible stuff. Okay, find him guilty. And then you go in to decide life or death. What will the sentence be? So the foreman of the jury says, okay, we're going to have a little straw vote here. You know, everybody just, and this guy is telling me later, he says, you know, I thought, you know, democracy, like everybody just says, hey, what do you think? And they went around a circle. Death, 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 death. And they come to him and he says, hey, let the guy live. I mean, you know, he'll be in prison the rest of his life. And boy, he said, sister, they jumped on me like, well, he cleaned it up later and called it gravy on rice, but that isn't the first thing he said. And I saying to him, if we don't do this, this guy's going to get out in 7 years, he's going to kill again. Because, you know, it used to be that juries could not be told what the sentence would be if they didn't give death. And so to protect the community, they were voting for death. And now the reason that death sentences have been cut in half in the United States, jurors have to be told what the alternative sentence is. So they see they can protect the community without killing someone. And the guy caved in. He caved in to pressure. And the night Robert Sawyer was executed, before they had the hearings and this juror looked in the paper, because Nick Trenacosta and these really good lawyers were finally having the hearings to show that Robert Sawyer, they had done MRI, that he had brain damage, that it was never told the jury. And he looked at it one day and he went, that it was what he feared the most. And now they were going to execute Robert Sawyer. And the night they executed Robert, he called Nick, the lawyer, and he was drunk. And he said to him, I'm telling my son, I keep telling my son, son, never give in to pressure. You stand up for your beliefs no matter what. Because then Robert Sawyer was executed, and his vote alone would have saved his life. Because every juror really ends up having that person's life in their hands, because one vote, and you don't have it unanimous, it means a person lives. And all this is put on the shoulders of ordinary citizens to try to carry. And so now, and then they... a year later, all the, imagine how the 122 people that have been wrongly convicted, how their jurors feel. Who went, oh man, we condemned that person to death. We did the best we could with what we had, but what do we know? Because it's on the presumption that absolute truth can come out in a very human forum, which is called a courtroom, and that everybody can jump through all the legal hoops to be able to tell the truth. And we're never going to be able to do that. So Death of Innocence takes you through two stories. Joseph O'Dell, the second story, is, well, we got any Italians in here tonight? Because I want to hold up my hand for Italy. Let me tell you what. The Italian people heard about this man, Joseph O'Dell, in Virginia, and the young woman who was trying to save his life, who was a volunteer in the Innocence Project. And Italy got involved. The Italian parliament got involved. The mayor of Palermo came over to Virginia, visited Joseph, made him an honorary citizen of Palermo. And he says to Joseph, Joseph, if Virginia kills you, we will bury you in a very special graveyard, an honored grave in Palermo. And in the end, that is exactly what happened. And Virginia executed Joseph O'Dell, and then they destroyed the DNA evidence, and it could never be. We're in the southern states. We're in the states that where you've always had political fodder for upholding the death penalty, which has mainly been to control the criminal element. And you know where we see race in the death penalty? If you look on death rows across the United States, you'll see it's about 48% white people and about 48% people of color or other. But where you really see it is in the race of the victim. 87% of the 1,000-plus people who have been executed because they killed a white person. When people of color are killed in this country, it's not even a blip on the radar screen. It's a negligible death. Native American people, Latinos, Latinas, white people. And I noticed that when I went to St. Thomas and I was reading the Times-Picayune, our New Orleans newspaper. People could be killed in St. Thomas and you were lucky if you could find it on page 30. Every single time a white person was killed, their photograph was on the front page of the paper in a story. Because you'd have to value life equally. And poor people and people of color, if you don't value their life equally, you're not going to be outraged over their death. We would have to fix everything to get that equal and get that squared away, and we're never going to be able to do that. And that's why the death penalty is always going to be skewed. And then the other thing, Joseph O'Dell, the Pope, John Paul, he got involved. He heard about Joseph, everybody, Mother Teresa, everybody heard about Joseph. It's wonderful. And Mother Teresa, you know, you picture Mother Teresa at Calcutta and this meek little saint and all, taking care of the poor in Calcutta, which is true as far as that goes. But when she was on the phone with Governor George Allen of Virginia, people who were in the room were going, he kept saying, but mother. I mean, boy, I mean, she goes after you, you know, like, why are you going to kill this man? One time when she visited death row in San Quentin when she left the prison, she poked a finger on the chest of the guard and said, remember, whatever you do to these men, you do to Christ. So she's on it. And then lawyers, this woman who got me involved in the case, and I ended up being with Joseph when he was executed, she was brought over to Italy. And I'll never forget the phone call because she called me and she'd say, her expression was, sugar, sugar, let me tell you what happened. So I answer the phone, sugar, guess what? The Italians, God bless them, the Italians are bringing me over to Italy because the people are picking up Joe's case. 10,000 faxes and phone calls have gone to the governor of Virginia, and they're bringing me over to Italy to talk, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to the Vatican, and I'm going to see the Pope. You could come with me, because like aren't popes and nuns like tight? And did I want to talk? to Pope John Paul about the death penalty, you better believe I wanted to talk to Pope, because I had my own, the Archbishop in New Orleans countering what I was doing in New Orleans, and the Catholic Church, the traditional teaching, like many Christian churches, it was, well, the state can execute to protect society, but things began to change, and in the Catholic Church, it began to change because Pope John Paul wrote a pastoral letter called an encyclical and pushed the death penalty to the edge. But he still left a great big old loophole saying, but in cases of absolute necessity, the state could execute. When I read that, and I had a chance to communicate with him. I couldn't do it in person because I had a friend who was dying of breast cancer. But I wrote him a letter which they put right in his hands. And this friend of mine in the Vatican said, we brought it right into him. He read every letter. Every word in your letter. And I told him, I just said, you left that big loophole in there. And the prosecutor in New Orleans, I mean, providentially, some things happened. He was doing an interview, and he quoted the Pope's words. He said, we can't get enough death penalties here in Louisiana, so everyone we get is an absolute necessity. And so I said, Your Holiness, your words are going to be quoted for death. And then I said, we got to close the loop and take a principled stand. Amnesty International has a principled stand. The UN Declaration of Human Rights has a principled stand. Articles 3, Articles 5, every human being has a right to life. Nobody should be subjected to cruel and degrading punishment or torture. And I said, when I'm walking with someone to their death and they're shackled hands and feet and have been rendered defenseless, and they say to me, Sister, pray that God holds up my legs. There is no dignity in this death, or do we only stand for the dignity of the innocent? And what they changed was they changed the Catholic Catechism, which is the official teaching of the Church. And on all moral issues, as a community, we grow. And as a modern society, we have a way to defend society. That's what prisons are for, without having to kill people. And then what they changed was the criterion they used for 1,700 years that the state could execute to defend society for grave or grievous crimes, and they cut out that criterion. They removed it. So it means it's not how grave or grievous the crime. If society has a way to defend itself without killing people, we don't want to be involved in killing people. And that's in the book. The letters in the book, the Catholic stories in the book. And it's not just Catholics. It's Christians. It's taking Christianity and helping it to be part of dealing with the social issues and sufferings and injustices that are in our day. And it's all about growing. It's all about growing morally, like we're doing here tonight. You're here because you're interested in going deeper into the truth. You're coming here tonight because you want to build a society where justice can be done. And I have to tell you that in Wisconsin, I mean, it isn't just your cheese and all that stuff that, you know, that people, you're refreshing. You're refreshing to us. Those of us working against the death penalty and for human rights, when I come to Wisconsin, I know I'm in a state where you've had the wisdom as a community to know that you don't want to get the government involved in killing and deciding to kill some among you. Yes, we're outraged by the crime. Yes, we have to deal with our outrage. But let's check it out and make sure we're outraged over the death of every citizen. Or is, in fact, there a selectivity in our outrage? If we hear that a homeless person was killed on the streets of Milwaukee during the night, do we feel the same outrage that we'd feel if it was a person who was a teacher or a judge? We have to, because we're not as close to each other, it's someone who's like us when they're killed. That's when we feel the most outrage and fear. So I'll be happy to sign books for you as long as you want to be here tonight. And now we can have a little conversation together, whatever you want to talk about. Yes, in the back. Chapters 3 and 4, The Machinery of Death, Justice Scalia. Oh, let me tell you what. That's not a past tense question. Dobie, well, you'll read. Dobie was scared of needles. He had been brought into the death house. Here's why it is torture, and we can't escape torture in the death penalty. It's a mental torture. He was brought into the death house three times before he was killed. He got within an hour and a half of death twice, got a stay of execution on a legal question, brought back to his cell, then brought back, saying goodbye to his mother's family and all. And on the third time, he just said, Sister Helen, I need it to be over. And I knew what he meant. You can't keep summoning up the dignity. And he was so brave. And I was really like his coach because I knew he was scared. And so I'm saying, Dobie, you're about to do the bravest thing you ever did in your life. And look, you have Jesus here with you. He's going to help you. And he stood. His last words were like to forgive his persecutors, and he was turning to get on the gurney. But before we had left, I said, Dobie, you got to help me. I'm going to be calling on you to help me. You know, and life is a mystery, okay? On this side, it's a mystery. On the other side, it's a mystery. Let's just talk about mystery on top of mystery. But I believe all of life is connected. And I said, Dobie, I need you to help me. I will carry on this. And it's in fidelity to Dobie and the other five people I have accompanied who looked at my face when they were killed that I carry with me. People say, where do you get all this energy and all this fire? And I say, I'll tell you where I get the energy. I've accompanied six human beings and watched them be killed. I can't be neutral. I can't say, well, I'm going to go to graduate school and go do something else. I got to do this. And it's in fidelity to him to tell the stories. And I said, Dobie, will you be there with me? And he says, Sister Helen, I will. And I summon him. And we do that. I feel my mom inside of me. I feel my daddy. My daddy was a lawyer. I feel daddy inside of me. Somehow all of life is connected. I don't know how to begin to tell you how that is, but it is. Sometimes when I attend a liturgy in the Catholic Church, and there's a procession right before Eucharist as people are coming in, and I picture Dobie walking up. I picture Pat. I picture Robert Willie. I picture Willie Celestine. I picture Joseph Odell. I picture James Aldridge. All the people I've accompanied, and I picture them going up. There's a scene in Dead Man Walking. By the way, Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon, we worked very closely on every scene of that movie. They wanted to get it right to help the American public to go to deeper reflection. And those of you that saw the movie, if you remember, there was a scene where we're all at table and Matthew Poncelet sitting at the table in a red plaid shirt with the family. And I have dreamed at times that those who have been executed have been at a meal with the family or something like that. It's just all mixed in there together. I don't know if you remember that scene in the movie. It's kind of a busy time in the film, but it's in there too. Yes. Health care for the homeless. Good for you. Yes. Yeah, mental health especially, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Wait, let me just, I don't know if everybody can hear, but poor people have no voice and they have no political clout. That is absolutely true. Can everybody hear? You need to really slow down and speak out. When Johnson had his war on poverty. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Affordable housing started being cut under Nixon. We don't have affordable housing. You can see it in New Orleans right now. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yes, thank you. Right. Yes. That's right. Thank you. I don't know that we really have two parties. I think we may have just a business party in the United States because they're indistinguishable from each other. The anti-crime bill was passed under Clinton where they extended the death penalty federally to 60, over 60 crimes, including federal poultry inspectors. What? We go, what? Federal poultry inspectors? You get the death penalty for, okay, kingpins for drugs, never defined kingpins. Federal poultry inspectors means that there was a constituent in some congressperson's place who was inspecting chickens and somebody killed him, and he throws that in, federal poultry inspectors. You got pork barreling at its worst with this meritocracy for who deserves the death penalty. And it's not about justice. How are we ever going to get justice, and how are we going to get a working democracy in this country? We're going to get it by just this kind of stuff that's going on here tonight. We, the citizens, have to wake up, and we got to be involved. We have to be involved. If we're not involved, then we're really part of the problem. Because we just letting it go. We got to begin to speak up. I do a lot of speaking at universities and colleges and getting young people to get involved in the political scene and not be passive. Well, it doesn't affect my life, and we got to begin to get involved. We don't have a working democracy. I don't think we have a working democracy right now. And the death penalty is the epitome of a lot of things. All the deepest wounds of our society are in this issue. It's not about what to do with a few terrible criminals and whether we can kill them. Only poor people are selected. Mostly people who kill white people are selected. And the penchant that we have in this country to try to solve our social problems with violence. It's a violent solution to a social problem. Somebody else. Yes, you. Okay. Just stand up. Yeah, Bud Welt. Yeah. 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 With Bud Welch's daughter Julie was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing. And he's so honest. I mean, these people that belong to Murder Victims Families for Human Rights, they're just so honest about their own journey. And he would be the first one, he said, who wanted to kill Timothy McVeigh with his bare hands. I mean, Julie had graduated from Marquette. She knew three languages. She was in the Murrah building that morning because she's translating for some soul from Spanish to English trying to get Social Security straight. The bomb goes off. Julie's dead. And Bud says, every morning when I got up, all I could think of was get McVeigh. And his story is, I end with two stories. His is one of them. And he said, I understood why they put that lead vest on McVeigh whenever they took him out of the police car into the court, because I would have been waiting to kill him, to shoot him and kill him. He killed our Julie. And then he said, but I was smoking 5.5 packs of cigarettes a day, and I'm drinking to go to sleep at night. And his epiphany came. He was in the car. This is about 2 months after Julie's death, and he went to turn on the car radio. And he remembers being in the car with Julie. The news was on. They were talking about an execution in Texas, and she had turned to him and said, Dad, that's about nothing but vengeance. And then, of course, he remembers that Julie had begun an Amnesty International group in high school. And he couldn't honor her by asking for the death of Timothy McVeigh. And he goes even further. He goes and visits Bill McVeigh, the father. And you know what's so good about Bud? He's an ordinary human being. This incredibly bad thing happened. And he, like, becomes a witness to all of us that ordinary human beings can go through this terrible ordeal and be thrown into the fire, and they can come out whole. And I was with him in Moscow, and we were speaking there to the Russian people, to the, you know, who had put a moratorium on the death penalty. And Bud Welch's witness is just so amazing, and he's just so human, and he's so real. And he doesn't, you know, make short shrift of, yeah, I wanted to kill him. Who wouldn't want to kill him? In the first stages, anger is all a victim's family has. It gets the adrenaline going, and it keeps them from collapsing. But if the anger stays, like Lloyd LeBlanc says, Dead Man Walking, my hero in that book, he said, they kill my son, but I'm a kind and loving man. I'm not going to let them kill me. Because if I hate them, I'm going to be dead too. And I'm not going to let, and it's really an example of love overcoming hatred. You know, people say love is a strong thing, but then you hear these people say, yeah, well, look, love only goes so far. We got to talk about justice now. We got to talk about tough love. And they killed and they deserve to be killed. He's wonderful. I'm glad he got to speak to 20,000 young people. That is magnificent. I'd want to see his voice go over this whole planet. Yes.
I mean, if the guy has said he's sorry, he's going to be saved, and according to their theology. So why do they think the death penalty is punishment from those two angles I've never understood?
Well, you see, you're doing some thinking about it, yeah. For one thing. A lot of this, you got to realize how knee-jerk the whole thing is. I mean, you know, it's like in the Bible quoting that goes on. I mean, but we're at a pitiful stage here in biblical education in this country. I mean, did you hear that poll? 21% of the American people think Joan of Arc was Noah's wife. I mean, not in Wisconsin, of course. Not in Wisconsin. So imagine. imagine how the Bible's quoted. I mean, I've been on all these radio talk shows, you know, in North Carolina. Okay, we'll open the phone, start callers. Okay, Chuck, you're on. Sister here, the good sister, says Jesus wouldn't pull a switch. What do you say, Chuck? And he goes, well, I got my Bible open right here. Those who shed blood will have their blood shed. You have the most selective use of the Bible. There were 37 different crimes in the Old Testament for which you could get the death penalty. 37. They didn't have prisons. They didn't have, and so you could get it for not observing a Sabbath, sassing a priest, not obeying your parents. And I tell the college kids, they love this part. If you had sex with an animal, you got it, and the animal got the death penalty too, consenting or not. And they call it like biblical quarterbacking. You toss your quote, I'll cross. And they quote Jesus, just anything out of context. Justice Antonin Scalia, Supreme Court of the United States, graduated from Georgetown. Wait until you see his religious argument, quoting the Bible, of why divine authority has been given over to civil government to execute the wrath of the sword on evildoers. Divine authority has been given. I mean, that's a theocracy. Where do you read? Where do you read this? Okay, so this is Christianity light, and just people just quoting that. And then the other, like, jury.